Kathy down here?
Wonderful music this morning, all over the place. Great. Wow. I'd love to believe it. Any of it. Just the littlest bit of it. Just one lousy barrel of water turned into wine. Just half a barrel. A quart. I'll even sell it for a pint. For those of you who caught the sermon I did last spring when I paid tribute to the recently departed author John Updike, the words might ring a bell because I used them then. They're spoken by a fictitious character named Freddie Thorne, who was a dentist in Updike's novel Couples. The setting where he says this is a wine and cheese party in an upscale North Shore, Massachusetts neighborhood where a lot of Updike's novels took place, and where the subject has gotten around to religion. Most of the attendees at this party have fallen away from one version of Protestant Christianity or another. I think Updike probably throws in a lapsed Catholic here or there as well. And they'd all learned in their Sunday school days or their CCD days the story of Jesus turning the water into wine at the wedding feast at Cana. And that's the story that is recalled as they sip their own wine and munch on their hors d'oeuvres, and since it is an Updike novel after all, exchange fleeting glances between whichever ones are having affairs with whichever other ones. The novel's one-word title, Couples, operates on several levels. Well, now, Freddie is the self-designated cynic in this circle of sort of friends, and yet read in a certain way. I come back to this passage from time to time. You read it in a certain way, you see Freddie Thorne, with just those few words of his, go from scoffing to pleading. It's like it goes from, yeah, sure, I'd love to believe that, to, can't I have just a little something to hold on to? A little bit of the miraculous or the mysterious I can believe in? Hey, I'll even settle for a pint. The genius of John Updike, like that of any good writer, is that he could capture a world in just a few words. And in as secular a setting as he could make it, and with as secular a character as Freddie Thorne, Updike captured the truth about religion and belief in the modern West in just that one little vignette there. Fundamentalists accepted, we as people have developed minds that take our thinking well beyond the literalness of the myths and the legends and the fanciful stories that are contained in most of the world's religious traditions. At the same time, though, we still continue to reach beyond ourselves in some kind of desire to connect with something greater than ourselves. And we sometimes experience that reaching out with some of our more secular pursuits and our secular ambitions bring us up short to the point that we'll even sell for a pint. Well, this same dilemma was summed up in another way, I mean, summed up by a very gifted individual who works in a field quite different from that of John Updike. This is Dr. Edward O. Wilson, by one of the more renowned and widely written, widely recognized biologists of our time. In one of his writings, Wilson said, "The human mind has evolved to believe in gods and not in biology." I thought that was a pretty remarkable statement, coming as it did from a world-renowned biologist who spent most of his years down at the Harvard University. I believe what Dr. Wilson is saying with this is that while we have minds that can question and in cases, in many cases, reject some of the more traditional aspects of traditional religion, we are unable, we are unwilling, in fact, to reduce ourselves to just biological entities. We human beings are the species on this planet who have evolved to the point that we ask the why question in ways that I doubt any other creatures with whom we share this planet do. We are the ones who have memory and we look back and also look forward in a way that I doubt other creatures on this planet do, to borrow John's words from the reflection. We're the ones that are charged with remembering the September. We're We're also the ones who have figured it out, that we're going to die. And therefore, we are the ones who seek, if not demand, some greater meaning to our lives in the face of our mortality. One of the many gifts and legacies that the recently departed Forest Church left to our movement was that definition of religion that gets invoked so many times, that religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and knowing that we will die. It's how we come to terms with our finitude because we have that kind of an awareness in ways most other, if not all other creatures on this planet do. We have evolved, that is to say, to be believers. However much we, like Upright Freddie Thorn, may argue with the content of belief. And I think Freddie's plea, "I'd love to believe it," resonates well. Well, I plan to devote several sermons to this theme over the course of our church here, so consider this a heads up. They roughly parallel some chapters I envision. I seem to got the book bug again over the summer, and so I'm sort of got the idea of this book using the same title as this sermon, Belief for Non-Believers. So I got a toehold start in it over the summer, and I figured one way to keep me working on the thing is to make me do sermons that I can then turn into chapters. So what you're getting today is kind of a working draft of chapter one. I'll make one more pass at Dr. Wilson. He notes, "Humankind has produced 100,000 religions. It is an illusion to think that scientific humanism and learning will dispel religious belief." I'm not sure where Wilson gets that 100,000 religion figure. That sounds a little high to me, but I'm not going to quibble over it because his larger point is well taken. Whether one chooses to call it religion or not, we all pursue belief of one kind or another. And this is why I take exception to the very term non-believer, since I don't really think there are any such folk, except maybe for the occasional out-and-out nihilist, nihilism being the rejection of all belief, which is a form of belief in and of itself. Now, the term non-believer is generally used to refer to persons who have rejected the beliefs, with a small b, of one traditional religion or another, or who have rejected some of the more traditional concepts of God. But I would say that such rejection in and of itself does not make one a non-believer. And this gets me to the argument I have with Richard Dawkins and his book, The God Delusion. I did a whole sermon on Dawkins a couple years ago when the book first came out, so I'm just going to do a quick flyby here this morning. I have very little quarrel with Dawkins when it comes to his debunking the idea of a supernatural supreme being who can work his or her or its will on the world, or who stands on the side of one particular nation against another, or on the side of one particular ideology against all others. Such a God is indeed a delusion, and oftentimes, as we have seen, a very dangerous and deadly delusion. Well, my quarrel with Dawkins instead is over how he frames the debate. He first puts forth what he calls the God hypothesis, which he defines in this way. There exists a superhuman, supernatural intelligence who deliberately designed and created the universe and everything in it, including us. He then goes on to state that this is the only idea of God that is worth debating. He defines the debate, that is to say, on his own terms, and then, surprise, surprise, goes on to win the debate. Not that hard to win a game at all when you're the one who is making the rules. I will grant Dr. Dawkins that his God hypothesis is the most commonly held one, but it's far from being the only one. Seems to me that what he's doing is taking a particular notion of God, puts it in a box, and then blows up the box. He doesn't want to muddy up his God hypothesis with anything that gets outside of or beyond his box. He has little use, for example, for another way of believing called naturalistic theology. Naturalistic theology holds that some sense of the holy, some sense of the sacred, some sense of the divine, whom some who think and believe this way call God, can be found within the natural world and universe, and there's no need to look anywhere beyond that. Just so you don't try to psych me out, this is the camp I happen to find myself in these days, even though I go pretty light on the God references myself. I will say before leaving Dawkins, to give him his due credit, he does a good job of clearing away the nonsense, or the underbrush, or the debris, when it comes to find a sustaining place to stand as we encounter our world and our universe. Borrow a metaphor I used last week when it comes to finding a place to park our car. Dawkins seems to think, however, that once the clearing out is done, the job itself is done. I would say you clear out the clearing so you can then build you a house or make you a parking place, wherever you want to put it. What Dawkins does is offer a starting point rather than a conclusion. And as a counterpoint to his God delusion, I would offer the just cited line from Dr. Evo Wilson. It is an illusion to think that scientific humanism and learning will dispel religious belief. Well, moving out from that, the conclusion I've come to at this point in my life, when it comes to matters of religious belief, is that being a believer means living and acting and relating and taking stands as if certain things are true, in the absence of sure and absolute knowledge. I got a little childhood story to make this point that I'm going to share with you by one of my ministerial colleagues, Reverend Terry Sweetser. Here's his story. I was 7 years old when I had my first encounter with theology. My mother made a batch of fudge, placed it in the refrigerator, and decreed it could not be sampled until after supper. I was not pleased. I contrived every scheme I could imagine to sneak some, but someone always seemed to be in the kitchen. About 4 o'clock, I got a break. My mother and sister had to go to the store, leaving me alone. Mother must have been reading my mind because she gave me a warning on the way out. Just because I'm not here, don't think you're alone with the fudge. God is watching you. Terry was honest. The word theology means God's study. As they drove off, I was studying hard. It did not take me long to conclude that I was a 7-year-old atheist. Boy, did that fudge taste good. Unfortunately for me, my mother had counted the pieces, and the recount on her return showed a deficit of 3. When asked how I could have brazenly taken the fudge in front of God, I said, I don't believe in God. My ever practical Unitarian mother responded while administering my first spanking, it would be in your best interest to act as if God were there. Well, as you picked up, that's a very lighthearted, even with the spanking part, humorous kind of a story, which is what Terry intends in telling it. In fact, sort of he wrote his book on the similar subject as I'm writing mine, and he called it As If God Were There. I guess some of your childhood experiences kind of stay with you. But it's a lighthearted way of getting at this deeper issue, I think, of what it means to be a person of faith, a believer. Living by faith, living with belief, belief with a capital B now, does not mean clinging to or grasping after some kind of alleged or supposed certainty. That is a delusion. But there's another way, I think, of being a believer. It means living as if certain truths abide. Or to put it in the language of theology, as if God were there. I got a number of gifts last summer, and I shared some of them last Sunday from one of my spiritual guides, Sam Keen, in the week I spent taking the seminar he offered out at the Pacific School of Religion. As I said, I shared some of that last Sunday. I'm just going to revisit a little bit of it today. But one such gift was his idea, which he did share in this seminar, of what he calls radical trust. And I think radical trust is the real counterpoint to blind or unquestioning faith. It is a third way of being a believer. The usual dichotomy which Dawkins and others put forth is that you kind of have this reflexive or largely unexamined belief on the one hand or atheistic non-belief on the other. Keen's radical trust is a third way. Radical trust is not a creed. It's is not a set of prescribed beliefs, but rather it is an attitude, a stance, a choice to walk through life as if certain things are true, and as if you will be supported and nurtured and sustained as you take your walk. Now, Dr. King's favorite metaphor for radical trust is one I know I've used a few other times, and he revisited back in our week together. Decided to stay in the same pulpit for 22 years. You're going to tell the same stories a few times at least. This one of Sam King's is a TV cartoon. He recalled from his childhood of a cat being chased by a dog until the cat comes to the edge of the lake with the dog bearing down on it. Without breaking stride, the cat just starts running right across the lake, looking straight ahead. And as the cat runs, a series of lily pads keep coming up to meet his feet just as they're about to hit the water. And the cat is doing just fine running along like this until he looks down and gets anxious about whether the next lily pad is going to appear or not, which is when the lily pads stop and the poor creature sinks, much to the delight of the dog who stands on the shore and laughs. Well, that little story, I think I first read it about 40 years ago, that little story has been one of my metaphors for living much of my life. To walk as if I will be sustained on my journey, even though I don't know where the lily pads are ultimately coming from, and try not to get too anxious about when and where and how the next one is going to appear. That's radical trust. Sam King's other term for radical trust is what he calls trustful agnosticism. That is to say, living with an attitude or stance of trust towards life itself, even as you make no claim to have any sure or absolute knowledge of where that trust is ultimately grounded, where it's ultimately coming from. It is to live with what another theologian, Dr. Paul Tillich, called the courage to be. The courage, that is, to walk through life, continuing to believe in life, even with all the wounds and the scars and the pain that we know life can visit upon us. And this finally gets me to Woody Guthrie. When Kathy, Dan, and Harry put that Spirit of Woody Guthrie service together back in March, and I was going through a lot of his lesser-known songs to pick out the ones that we would be using to sort of show his religious and spiritual side, I found myself quite taken by his poem. Woody never wrote the music to what you just heard. It was a poem he wrote, later set to music by Ellis Paul, called God's Promise. And the thing that intrigued me was that although Woody titled it God's Promise, there's no actual reference to a deity anywhere in it. We don't really know who the I is that purports to be speaking here. Well, speaking personally and recalling King's trustful agnosticism, I find I don't need to know who or what is finally speaking those words. I just need to know that they're true, that they offer the message that I need to hear from life itself and the ongoing flow of life, even as I live my individual life for as long as I have it to live. Maybe the message comes from that same voice that Woody once heard chanting, "This land was made for you and me." Well, wherever it comes from, the message is one worthy of trust. I didn't promise you skies painted blue, not colored flowers all your day through. I didn't promise you sun with no rain, joys without sorrow, peace without pain. No, instead, all that I promise is strength for this day, rest for the worker, and light on your way. As I say, where this message, where this promise comes from is not near as important as that we get it and believe it and trust it. It is a message, as I feel, comes just from life itself. I'm looking at it in one other way. It also speaks, these words also speak to what I feel we must offer one another in this beloved community we continue to build. Strength for this day. Rest as we work, and light on our way. We're also called to offer one another truth when we need it, an unfailing love. And so we live the only lives we have, in the only world we've been given to live them in. And what we mostly need to believe is that this is enough. And that's the message of our closing hymn, too. Let's sing it together here on the path of every day. It's number 312.